So we're talking about the synopses, and you hear this phrase, you know, the synopses that fire together, wire together. So when you have a trauma or you're experiencing an ongoing stress, the synopses that are firing together are the ones that are reinforcing the feelings of stress and trauma. This leads us to how, you know, how triggering worked and how these prolonged episodes go on and on is because the brain has literally been wired to stay in a depressive state. And that's really depressing.
Depression is one of the trickiest and most universal subject matters in these modern times. It's been a major part of both Trey and Jenny's lives, as well as the lives of our families and friends. In this episode, we speak frankly about how it's affected our time on this plane of existence and what we hope for our futures, despite being wired for despair. Added points for the look at generational impacts and approaches to melancholy management.
And meow, meow. Hello, meow, meow. Trey. How are you today?
Well, I am certainly in the mind or the mood set for an episode about depression.
Yes, getting in the feels today. Yeah, me too. I mean, like, I'm always in the mood for depression. I won't lie to you. but yeah, I agree. I don't know. I definitely feel like before we started the episode, you were saying you like that we need to talk about why we're doing this episode and like what's going on with us right now. And I'm definitely going through a lot right now, but I've lived with depression my entire life. It's like the mental illness that is so wrapped up in everything that I do and everything that I am. And it's so wrapped up in my writing and my art and me as a person that it's like, I know it really well. I've lived it for a while. So like we were talking about doing this as a topic and then I pushed because I feel like I have a lot to say about depression. So yeah, but it is nice that I've been rolling through the emotions pretty heavy. So I'm naturally really tired, which is the perfect time to talk about depression.
when you don't have the energy for defenses or yes. for getting angry.
Exactly.
Well done. Well done. Well, for our listeners, I'll just go ahead and throw this out there that, you know, kind of a trigger warning, like this is an episode about depression. Yeah. I mean, we're not going to go insanely dark with it, but it may not be your jam. You know, we certainly don't want to trigger anyone.
And we're not going to talk about like SI or attempts or thoughts or anything like that. Specifically because I personally, and I think Trey agrees that depression gets conflated with those things a lot. And yes, those are a really big part of depression and aren't necessarily something that should be ignored. But I also don't necessarily think the conversation of depression always needs to center around those. And hopefully this will make this episode less triggering for some of y'all. We're still going to off the cuff it, but then I'll just edit things out if we have to at the end. But
no sweat. Yeah, but bottom line is, you know, we are living with depression, whatever that means. And that's kind of what we're going to be exploring today. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's the focus for today's episode. So if this is not your jam or if you're in a particularly sensitive spot, maybe this isn't the episode for you right now, but we are going to come around to talking about some of the things that have helped us live with depression, and there might be some value in that for you.
Yeah, and we will definitely try and make it lighter next week and a lighter topic next week. I think we had talked about doing movies.
Skip to the movie episode. We wish we could.
Yeah. But yeah, we're doing this with everybody in mind. We're doing it no camera just because that was my idea. And I just feel like it's a little more intimate and it can be a little more off the cuff. And because I voted that we look like crap today, so I look like crap. But that's okay because Rihanna says you should dress how you feel. And like, I feel like I should feel a little low for the depression episode. So I should also look like crap.
Well, hey, I managed to get a shower in. And let me tell you, when the depression is at its worst, like, hygiene is not a priority. That's for sure.
I feel like that's a really, like, it's just really hard. I don't know if we've had conversations about spoons in, on this podcast in the past and what the ideology behind spoons is, but, like, the idea being that how many spoons you have is how much energy you have to give to something throughout the day. And you start the day off with so many spoons and then you end the day with zero spoons because you've given them out. And yeah, when you're depressed, oh my God, everything costs so many freaking spoons. Like showering, doing hygiene, it's just, it's this incredible, incredible battle. And for me, the depression really matches up with the ADHD well, because like of this idea of ADHD paralysis of like I'm thinking too much and I can't do anything. It almost turns into like depression paralysis where I'm just like so low energy and so low spoons and low idea of myself that it's like I can't do anything. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to move from this spot on the couch or the floor. And, you know, I can barely turn the TV on. So, I mean, I guess I can just segue it first and just say I did a little bit of back-end research on depression, and maybe this will help spur things for more. I'm not going to list the symptoms of depression because I feel like that's something that's bounced around a lot and people have heard a lot. And
we'll put a link in the show notes.
We have
a great resource for that.
Yeah, and I don't know why I shied away from it, but yeah, we'll put a link. But it's worth noting that according to the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, 77%, at least 60 million of Americans have had at least one major depressive episode in the last year. So about 6% to 7% of Americans deal with depression, which personally, I thought that number was going to be a lot higher. And I personally think it probably is, but I don't know how many people are accurately reporting themselves as being depressed. Women are 70% more likely to experience depression than men. And then young adults between 18 and 25 are 60% more likely to experience it than adults over 50.
Wow.
Which also makes sense because like brain development and stuff. And then I guess when you're past 50, maybe you're just like, I'm settled in. I don't know, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, please tell me what it's like past 50.
No. Don't look at me.
But I mean, it is a thing to talk about because one of the, you know, aspects of the show is like the different generational pieces of this. So I'm always paying attention to what's happening with, you know, with the young folks because I'm in classrooms with them. And it's very good to know not only being able to identify what's, you know, like if somebody is, you know, having a hard time of it, but also kind of knowing what the overall trends are. And the trends have been going down. You know, folks are, that doesn't sound right. Folks are having more and more depression and anxiety.
Yes. I was confused, but I'm caught up now.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was like, I don't know. Cause like, I definitely was tempted to just ask like, how many of your friends would you say when you were like in the young adult era of your life, would you say were depressed, or, you know, how many people that you were interacting with would you consider to be depressed people? And maybe that includes now too.
Well, I was a theater kid. So this was
so
the 80s.
All of you.
So all of them. but that said, you know, part of the coping, because, you know, as a Gen Xer, we didn't know what depression was. There was no terminology around it. It was a bad thing. That's the only thing we knew. Occasionally, you know, there'd be a magazine like 17 or something back when that existed, where it would say, it would give you like a little quiz. Are you showing depressive symptoms? So like very few people were touching on it, much less like what to do about it. There'd be like, buy yourself a pretty new frock and, you know, your problems will be solved. There just wasn't any support or real.
Especially if there was depression quizzes in magazines, like that's mind blowing to me. Like today, that sounds like just such a terrible idea of just like, are you depressed? Let's do this little magazine quiz. And oh, I'm depressed. According to this, that's wild. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It was a new term, you know, and people weren't dealing with it, but that's really, really fascinating to me. Yeah. That just sounds like really outlandish today, you know, because everybody's depressed today or feels like it. And so it's like, you don't want to put that in a magazine of like reminding people
because it might
depressed.
Be triggering.
Yes,
what's
exactly.
triggering? It's 1986. We have no idea
so
what triggering
right.
is. But it, you know, it's a good point. I know that once I started connecting to, and we'll talk about this next week, but like looking for role models, looking for people who were living our same experience. So I was always attracted to the stories where people were demonstrating the same, you know, I can't even call it a symptom because I didn't understand that depression had symptoms, okay. but just, you know, felt the way I felt. And I think that's a fairly natural thing to do as a young person is, you know, like to make those connections usually through, I mean, it would be great if it was through friendship groups, but oh my gosh, we just went through 3 years where everybody got really sequestered and, you know, and apparently your generation isn't great. I don't know. Is your generation the one who's supposed to not be good at socializing or is that the one before you? I forget.
The one before us is like millennials. And I feel like millennials definitely have their own version of socialization. I think my generation is the generation that's supposed to be bad at socializing. And I think in a lot of ways we are, but I also think in a lot of ways it's just because socialization among my generation is very different. And so it's viewed as, you know, all things that are different are viewed as bad, but like, you know, I have so many people that I know and so many friends who a lot of their friend list is like online people, you know, and like that they have these really awesome virtual friendships of people that they talk to every day, you know, and I definitely have a much easier time communicating my emotions and what's going on in my head over text than I do in person. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a symptom of my generation. I think all generations have had their own troubles communicating their emotions and with people. I just think doing it not face to face is a lot easier. Same for the same horrible reason that cyberbullying is a lot easier, where it's just like you're not facing it, you know, and you're not looking into somebody's eyes while you're telling them that I've been really depressed and not having a good time. So I guess we're bad at it, but like,
And one of the symptoms of depression is disassociation, which can register a number of different ways, but it's a lack of connection to just what's happening around you. And in the extreme cases, it's, you know, it's leaving your body and letting your body go on autopilot, while you are kind of offloading in, you know, in I don't know where we go, but we're not present and accounted for. So it's the opposite of mindfulness.
Yeah.
And disassociation is easier. I mean, you know, form follows function. So texting is like disassociated intimate conversation.
Absolutely.
You can still get your point around, but you don't have to do it looking anybody in the eye.
Yeah, well, and it's a lot more convenient to what's going on in your life and your schedule. Like you can respond when you want. You don't have to leave the house and make plans to do things. And especially, you know, as we were talking about with low spoons with depression, it's hard to even get yourself to do the things that you normally enjoy. You know, it's hard to leave the house and go outside and experience the world. And like, I don't know, especially because you brought up dissociation, and I have some statistics, I have some facts about scientifically depression kind of is, but like for me personally with ADHD, I dissociate a lot anyway, and I have a hard time getting the serotonin and dopamine I need. So I feel like depression just runs really thoroughly through me. And then I'm also bipolar type 2 on top of that, which I don't know if I've ever talked about on this podcast before. Maybe it's worth doing a bipolar episode, but essentially type 2 is categorized by the depressive episodes being a lot worse than the manic episodes. And like when I'm manic, I can get a lot done and I can be really productive and have really high highs in my life. But when I'm depressed, it's like a valley is being created in my life and I'm just, I'm terrible at everything. But essentially what I found is that depression, at first they thought it was quote unquote a chemical imbalance. This idea that there are not enough chemical transmitters in your brain, neurotransmitters. And so that things like serotonin couldn't stay in your synapses, you know, and they would, it would constantly get lost or misplaced. And serotonin and dopamine would just not be allowed to be in there regularly because of these imbalance in the chemical transmitters. So they created medication that was going to combat that. One of the most famous examples is Prozac. But what they found is that only 50%, 55.0% of the people who were taking it actually felt anything different and like it actually worked. And so the idea behind the chemical imbalance is flawed because it actually doesn't like connect with everybody. And like not everybody who has depression maybe actually has this chemical imbalance that we thought they had. So this group, basically there's this doctor who did this research and decided that maybe it was actually a different part of the brain. And so I'm just going to kind of read what I found online. And this, again, is from the Brain and Behavioral Research Fund. But this doctor named, this doctor named Dr. Malenka conducted a series of experiments involving neurons and wanted to know if it was having to do with this part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, or NAC for short, which is often called the pleasure circuit. Basically, it's the part of your brain that controls how you feel pleasure, when you feel pleasure. You know, it helps promote your survival. So like you feel pleasure during sex, you feel pleasure when the sun hits you and it's warm, you know, you feel pleasure when you're in a good blanket, or like water is really nice for you. Like just small things that are supposed to give you boosts of pleasure and boosts of serotonin is responsible in this part of the brain. And what the theory was, is that maybe something is actually going up with this part of the brain and that it isn't giving people pleasure when they want to. And what they found out is there is this hormone that affects appetite called melanocortin, and it turns off the brain's ability to experience pleasure when an animal is stressed. So it's literally this hormone that is being fed to our bodies when we're stressed that turns off our ability to be happy.
You are and now talking about my 20s, my 30s, yes, a bunch of my 40s.
And like it's scientifically saying that stress directly correlates to depression. And it's worth noting that there are three major types of depression, according to this research. Situational, meaning, you know, because of trauma or something happened that caused it. And sometimes that can go away, sometimes not. Persistent depressive disorder, where it's mild, but it lingers forever and like it stays with you. And then major depressive disorder, where it's not mild. And you'll have really, really hard periods. And, you know, what they found when they're doing this research is that no matter what they find, it's not going to encompass everybody, because just like gender and just like the ADHD autism spectrum, depression's also a spectrum, because these are people's brains we're dealing with. And that's the part that I found really fascinating, is the idea that people experience different kinds of depression than other people, you know, and that maybe the kind of depression that you feel and how it feels is a bit different than the one I do, you know, because of the chemicals in our brain misfiring and because of our NAC just not doing what the heck it's hecky spaghecky it's supposed to. So I don't know. I just think that's that?
The hecky spaghecky.
Well, it's because we, my partner says heggy spaghetti a lot. Yeah. And so then I changed it because I wanted it to rhyme because of my OCD.
Yes.
So
the reason.
Yeah. But that's what I found is, and I mean, it makes sense that stress is directly correspondent to it. And, you know, with what we were talking about earlier, that the newer generations just seem to have more and more of it. I also just think there's a lot more different kinds of stress nowadays than maybe there was back then, especially right. with social media and other things. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
That was awesome. Thank you so much for bringing that forward. One of the people that I follow on YouTube is a doctor named Tracy Marks, and I'll put some links in the show notes. You know, just to follow up what Jenny was talking about, that the medications were there, what they functionally were doing was just prolonging. So whatever of those, you know, good chemicals, the dopamine, the serotonin, there's another one I can never remember, that did get released, the medication prolonged their presence in the brain. Which kind of explains, if you think about the dynamics of the, you know, the release of the medicine and how you really can not feel great if you miss your medication that particular day, because it's very of the moment. Lots of people didn't respond to it. And then we started getting phrases like treatment resistant depression. Hello, I fall into that category. And what Dr. Marks was saying is that recently, and again, you guys, all of this has come out in like the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So not only are we talking about it, but the solutions are, they're infinitely better. You know, one of the things that we hear, people who have medical conditions that are seemingly hopeless and untreatable, the doctors will say, but at any time, there really could be a cure. Like, people are working on it. You know, hang in there. There could be a cure. Like, I didn't hang in there because I was hoping for a cure. But what I'm saying is the chances for treatment are infinitely better than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and certainly, you know, when I was growing up. And what they have discovered is let me come to my notes. So we're talking about the synapses, and you hear this phrase, you know, the synapses that fire together, wire together. So when you have a trauma or you're experiencing an ongoing stress, the synapses that are firing together are the ones that are reinforcing the feelings of stress and trauma. This leads us to how triggering worked and how these prolonged episodes go on and on is because the brain has literally been wired to stay in a depressive state. And that's really depressing. It's not something you heal from, as it turns out. It's not like a broken bone where, you know, get it reset and you'll be all better. So the very new phenomenon of looking at depression and anxiety and PTSD, because they all end up in a bucket together all the time. Mm-hmm. I see those three things grouped together, you know, that it is, it functions as a disease. So not an illness, not a condition, but an actual disease. But that neuroplasticity works both good and bad, right? So the neuroplasticity could be wiring things together in a way that has negative impacts on your moods and how you walk through this life. But yes, neuroplasticity exists throughout the entirety of your life. It doesn't matter how late you come to this, that if you can find the people and the treatment for you that starts rewiring your brain, you're treating the disease and you have a much better chance of going into remission of easing the symptoms, of, you know, just getting some relief to all of this. And it's too early to say if there's like a cure for this stuff, because this is a kind of a brand new approach to things, is this rewiring, as opposed to just treating the symptoms with medication. And please know, I'm not telling anyone, not a doctor, not telling anyone what to do with their bodies. If the medication is working, I am so very happy for you. If you're interested in trying out medication, like, wow, like I can't encourage that enough, because you never know what the thing is that's going to work for you.
Right.
But what we've come to is that there are more significant means of treating depression that allows the brain to actually heal itself. And Jenny, for you at your age to come in, you know, into the world at this time, it is terrible, but also, hey, there might actually be treatment. And then what if you got to live the entire rest of your life not trapped in this cycle? That thrills me to death.
Yeah, and I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about all of that, which I can delve into. But, like, first of all, I think that's really interesting and it makes a lot of sense to me. And my gut is telling me that, like, term, like, cure just doesn't apply to something like this, because, you know, the kind of treatment you're talking about is going to be so individualized for people.
For sure.
Especially because, like I said, my depression wraps up in my bipolar, my ADHD, and my gender dysphoria, all of which are chemical processes that are happening in my brain. And not everybody who is depressed is going to have bipolar and is going to be bipolar. But I know for a fact that treating my depression is going to be rerouting through the bipolar, you know, and be working with it or understanding it, which leads me into my other thought process of, like, you know, you described the synapses wiring together and firing together, and this idea that your brain is just reinforcing this depression, that this is how you exist. And that's very much been my life. There has not been a single year of my life that I haven't spent at least 2 months of it depressed. Mm. And because of that, I have a very volatile but yet romantic relationship with depression, you know, like,
define. You must unpack that. What does that mean?
It really ties into being a writer, but, like, for me, sadness is just so beautiful sometimes, you know, and there are moments where I'm so depressed and I'm so unhappy and I just sit with myself and allow it to exist, you know, and I sit in the depression's existence for a while, knowing my boundaries, of course, knowing when it's gone too far or if I feel unsafe, knowing when I'm at my cap. And I will caveat and say that there's only a certain amount of time I can spend in depression before it does get bad. So touche to that point. But there's a certain amount of depression that I'm actually genuinely afraid to lose, because I just see so much beauty in the world because of it, and so much beauty and sadness. And then there's movies that just portray this infinite sadness, and it just reaches into my core in the most beautiful and romantic way, and is so tied into what some of my love for movies, you know, like, Melancholia. It's just so beautiful, especially rewatch.
Melancholia. Who is that again? Who is the
Lars von Trier, of all people? It's his most
second
PC
appearance
movie.
On our podcast.
But, like, or just, I don't know, there's moments in, like, TV shows like Russian Doll. Like, I feel like only a certain percent of people experience depression the way I experience it. And when somebody I come across does, I can tell pretty immediately, especially in their art. And it's just really beautiful and romantic to me, and, like, just really encapsulates, like, I feel like mine's really tied to grief, and I don't know why, but my depression phases really feel like grief phases for my life. And to me, taking those away would be like taking away the grieving times, the opportunities to grieve, you know. It'd be like something bad happening to you and you saying you're not allowed to grieve it. you know, it feels like my entire life has been traumatic. And so the depression is me grieving that.
Right.
Which is really sad. But like, I don't know. And it also just could be the addiction center of my brain. Because when you're sad, you do start like overcompensating. And so a certain amount of sadness in your brain feels good because you start pumping out more chemicals to combat that. So I don't know. I don't know. But that's my two cents, is it's like, I have a relationship with it that maybe I shouldn't, or, you know, maybe I should.
Hey, we're not judging anybody. We're just trying to express. And that was really lovely. Do you feel like you had asked me if I, you know, in my youth had been surrounded by a lot of depression. So two-part question. Do you feel like you grew up with a lot of folks who also were experiencing sadness / depression? And do they have similar relationships to it as you?
I definitely didn't grow up around them. The high school that I went to was very rich and sheltered. And so I feel like the people who were depressed certainly weren't advertising it the same way I was and were sealing themselves off from it. And I think they also had the means to overcompensate, if you will, and do really bad things like drugs and other things. And I wasn't associating with those crowds in high school, not because I was judging them or anything, but just I think I knew deep down I was an addiction person, and that if I allowed myself any leeway in those areas, it was going to take my life off course. So I avoided them like the plague. But I actually suffered from a chronic lack of people around me who understood what I was going through. They understood sadness, but they didn't understand how depression is not sadness. It's way different. Depression is a state of being. You know, depression is a state of viewing the world. It's a void inside of you. It's just this, that's how I view it, as just this void. Now there are people who are around me who experience it, and I have made it that way. You know, and it's hard to say that they have the same relationship with it that I do, because one, I do really think a lot of it's tied into my art, and like movies had such a profound impact on who I am as a person that without the movies that I watched growing up, I would literally be a completely different person today. Like I learned so much through movies that, you know, without that connection, I don't know if I would have that experience with depression. And I think for a lot of people, the depression is very destructive. But there are also people in my life who are a little more emotionally regulated because they're older. And
because they're older, I don't know if we can automatically say that older equals wiser, you know, or more regulated or whatever.
I agree, and age is a number, but I also agree that I also feel like your 20s are very different emotionally than your 30s usually are, you know, and I feel like your 20s, you don't know what the heck is going on, and your 30s, you're starting to maybe understand what the heck is going on a little better and how you deal with it. You've just had more time to sit with your body and sit with the processes, and I do think that some of these people who, I don't want to say emotionally regulate better, but just allow themselves to feel it, there is a certain amount of slipping into an old blanket like it is for me with them, where it's just like, oh, it's my time to experience it, and this is what's going on. And,
right.
You know, I think all of us have definitely resigned fighting it because we haven't been medicated and because we didn't get the resources we needed growing up, that now that we're adults, we're just like, this is how it is. So I would be willing to accept that there's a certain part of that there with those people.
With those people. All right. There's like three things in there that like I would love to, and I'll only remember probably one and a half of them. I really should take notes during these conversations. I think that the generations that are coming up now, so yours and the folks behind you, they have choices and resources that did not exist. And I could not be more excited for this idea that you guys, all y'all youngins are going to be able to jump on the interwebs, and you're going to be able to get education about what's going on with you, but also like how, like what can I do about it? Sure, coming up, we had the books. I don't know why, but Flowers in the Attic.
Yes, such a classic.
And what is more depressing than being locked in an attic with your five siblings and reaching puberty? I mean, harrowing, people, harrowing. And I feel like that was our version of Victorian Gothic. You know, the weight of that, like when you were talking about the romance of sadness, I was thinking about like Wuthering Heights and, oh no, Jenny's going to date Heathcliff and, you know, like, is it romantic to have somebody who is obviously in such terrible turmoil and that opens all the, you know, I will fix them and et cetera, which is something for another episode, asparagus. But going back to like the getting older thing. So I actually think honestly that yes, your 20s, like this I feel like you and I can absolutely agree on that you really don't know anything, but at least you're starting to learn what questions you want to ask that's going to start defining some of the directions that you go in. And that's across the board of everything, romance and career and where you want to live and how you want to live and how you want to feel. And then when you get into your 30s, before, again, I'm really hoping that younger generations don't have this experience, but in your 30s, you tend to start to acquire responsibilities and, you know, and weight. And how would I explain weight? You know, you get better at your job, so now you have more responsibility and you're responsible for people, you're responsible for money. Maybe you want to buy a house and, oh my God, now you have that responsibility. And maybe you have kids and now you have that responsibility. And, you know, maybe your parents are getting older. And I feel like if you haven't set things up, and again, this is just me, if you haven't set yourself on a road to acquire the tools, then in fact, your 30s are just going to cement all of your worst freaking tendencies. And I remember in my 40s, because I do this a lot. This is why we have these conversations, Jenny, because both you and I really, really watch and observe and, you know, and accrue, you know, we're like human pollsters. And I started walking around saying, well, your 40s, as it turns out, is that moment where either you start becoming your best self or you start becoming your worst self. And to come into your later 40s, because a lot of women in particular have this kind of seismic break with society, late 30s to mid 40s, and it's our own version of a midlife crisis. But I was just talking to a friend of mine about this the other day. There are so many women who leave the corporate or, you know, institutional workforce because we simply can't take it one more minute. So the, you know, the systemic oppression, you know, watching the men get promoted and not having impact at our workplaces, not being listened to, and feeling like we're leaving our families behind if that's a thing that you've chosen to do. Or the divorces, like the marriage has, you know, absolutely demonstrated itself to be untenable and having to step away from that. And suddenly you have all of these women, it's a brain drain where all of these women step out of their societal roles that they were told that this was the jam and they open bed and breakfasts. Wow. they you know, open yoga studios, you know, any smaller, they open small businesses and women start, because they can't, because they've hit a bottom, they've gotten so depressed. And is it situational? Is it that they've been carrying it their whole lives and never got any help for it? And this is the breaking point. I don't know. You'd have to talk to a bunch of 40 something women. But our lives have in the past generationally, the last three or four generations have radically changed, where suddenly we are living so far outside of what society told us was the way things were going to be. The good news is, you know, we can now self-support in a way that previous generations, you know, my grandmother certainly couldn't. My grandmother was depressed her whole life. She was terrorized by her husband. She was on Valium. They used to have a name for it, Jenny. It was called Mother's Little Pill, because all of these women were so oppressed, and they hated their lives. They liked aspects, obviously. They didn't hate their children necessarily. I mean, some did, but they didn't get to do anything else except these very, very regimented things. And instead of being like, hey, there's all this untapped potential over there, like, what can we do to get these women, you know, contributing at the levels that they're able to? They're like, oh, here's some Valium, you know, go chill out. And wow. Honestly, everyone's like, your grandmother's a saint. And I'm like, my grandmother was stoned.
Wow.
Because she didn't dare divorce, because she would have starved to death, and she had a kid. Anyway, that was a little bit of a generational, like, let's look at the generations. I can't wait to see what you guys end up doing with your futures that perhaps we did not have opportunity or access to.
Well, and it's so nice to be on the other end of it, where there's a lot of what you said that I have to unpack, and like, some of it's asparagus, especially this idea of becoming your own boss later, especially because that's something that neurodivergent folks end up doing a lot, because they just really struggle being in the workforce, especially under people who don't understand how their brain works. Mm-hmm. And then being a woman on top of that, or being marginalized on top of that. I certainly have more empathy for that after being trans and seeing how my workplace life completely flipped, you know, and did a complete 180 from how it was. So that's really fascinating, and it makes a lot of sense. And I also feel like, I don't know, like, this is helpful for me because I definitely need to corral, I think I'm on the path for finding the tools for myself before I hit my 30s. It feels like that's what I'm doing. And I definitely think my affinity for depression definitely has its dangers, because there is a certain side of depression where I don't want to do anything. And obviously that is nothing but destructive for me. So I definitely feel like I don't know, because, you know, you were talking about like, oh, they have more resources to help with depression and they have more things that can potentially lead to a cure. I am just so tendenced to view it like how I view my bipolar and how I view my ADHD, where the cure is emotional regulation and the cure is you doing it, like, and figuring it out and figuring out how to live with it. And there are tools that will help, like medication, and sometimes you absolutely need those tools. But for me, it almost feels like I'm tendenced to believe that the treatments are more just really effective tools, you know, but that they're not a cure, and that the cure is still, right, you know.
So tools for management versus,
right,
tools.
And finding your inner peace is the cure.
Alas, our technology apparently was so depressed listening to us, it quit on us. There was more conversation, but it got lost. We still wanted to bring this last Trey moment to you, even in its broken state. And maybe that's appropriate for this week's subject. Cheers. Meow, meow.
Right. And, you know, I also want to mention that there are communities. First off, we're Americans. If y'all haven't noticed, we're Americans. And a piece of that is, you know, I came up lower middle class, I would say. Jenny, I don't know where in the caste system you identify, lower middle class. But, you know, I was raised around people who were impoverished, and it's a very different mindset. You know, you have this conversation with African Americans, and it looks very differently because the sense of oppression and persecution was much more acutely felt. And what it did to their communities is way different than when you're looking at it from a white person's perspective. I grew up in a biracial neighborhood, Latinos, and you know, poor white people, and that really, really formed a lot of how I look at the world. And it ain't no joke, but not being able to afford the fundamentals is stress, and it is a means of creating a depressive state. So on one hand, it's great to be, freelance and have scaled back your expectations of what this country can really, there is no American dream, you know, what can it deliver for you? But on the other hand, to still have the, and this goes for anyone and everyone, to still have the self-awareness that you can still acquire tools and seek out resources at any level that are going to start inching you forward so that the concept of peace of mind, because I think that's what everybody is pursuing. I know the day that I finally understood what peace of mind was a complete life changer. Here, I'm going to tell this story. So, I've never not been depressed. My earliest memories are depressed little young Trey. I certainly didn't know I was depressed. It's just what my state of being was. And it wasn't until I was about 40 or so that I finally connected. It's not like I wasn't seeking out some help because I started understanding, yes, I have depression. Yes, I have PTSD. Now, what do you do with it? Nothing. You're going to have that stuff for life. Oh, man. Darn it. Well, but maybe there's things that can be done. So I've slowly been becoming, kind of an expert both in the ways that this stuff can completely disassemble a human being, but also the ways that you can connect to moments of respite, which was really for a very long time all that I could aspire to. So I was going to a woman who did cranial sacral work. And I'm telling you, it changed my life. Did it fix it? No. But so a little bit of context. One of the ways that depression works on me is looping. So is that depression? Is that PTSD? You have it in common. So looping is just constant negativity and massive, massive, massive doses all the time. I would sit up all night and, just talk smack to myself all night long. It was horrible. My therapist said that I had the most overdeveloped superego of anybody she'd ever seen, which, hey, I'm an overachiever. Yay me. But what that really meant was that there was no individual voice. I did not exist. All that existed was this horror. It was horrible. Anyway, so part of it also was, it wasn't just bagging on me and bagging on everything around me. It was also looking out at the world and being able to extrapolate like what was going to happen next, and always, like watching people park and like judging their parking and knowing when there's going to be a car accident, because I could just look at the pattern. I always said like I'd make a great CIA analyst because I was in constant pattern analysis mode, which by the way is hypervigilance. I was always waiting, like, where's the danger. So I'm working with this cranial sacral person, and I don't even know how long, probably a couple of years, and I didn't want to work with her anymore. And I went in to complain to her. I'm just like, I feel like I have lost IQ points since I started working with you. And she's like, I don't understand what that means. And I go, because like when I look around, I'm not seeing the patterns. I'm not understanding. I can't hold the entire world in my head anymore and tell you what's going to happen here, and this, that, and the other. And she looked at me and she put a hand on my shoulder. She goes, Trey, that's called peace of mind. And I was like, what is happening? I had never had a moment of peace of mind my entire life. I did not understand what it meant. And it was, I never did heroin, but that phrase like chasing the dragon. I was like, okay, now I know what the target is. I want this all the time. I do not get to that all the time, but I have gotten to the point where I get to spend weeks, sometimes even a month or two, where I am in remission, where I'm not just beating the crap out of myself every single minute of every single day. The downside is living in 40 years of extreme pressure cooker stress like that has kind of wrecked my body. So I'm laughing because it's a Gen X coping mechanism. We laugh at our trauma. Ha! So now I'm in a position of trying to maintain the peace of mind components, which, by the way, the spirituality stuff, holy Toledo, that was another huge leap forward. So mind, body, spirit, we talk about that all the time, where I now at least have a chance at bringing myself out of my depression. The problem is the depression at this point is so ground in that every time I re-trigger, it's like an extreme between, it just feels worse, Jenny. My depressions feel so much worse because I was out of it. I think when you've been in depression for a long time, you live alongside of it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay.